now move north of the border. We're going to get to Colorado, okay, with Christy Wright's presentation. Christy worked as a probation officer in Colorado Springs for over 20 years, where she acquired her expertise in Colorado's criminal justice system. She holds a master's degree in sociology from the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs. After retiring, she focused on her passion for Park County, Colorado history. She is president of the Park County Local History Archives and secretary of the Park County Mining Association. Christy's forthcoming book entitled South Park Perils, Short Ropes and True Tales details the county's fatal dastardly deeds during its Wild West era. Christy.
Thank you. Using the definition of a massacre as the killing of non-combatant people, I will be examining 10 murders, or mini-massacres, as I've termed them, that occurred in Park County, Colorado from the spring of 1879 through the spring of 1880. This was 10 mini-massacres in just 1 year's time, or almost one per month. These mini-massacres prompted two lynchings, or mob massacres, in the spring of 1880. This happened as the towns of Alma and Fairplay tried to reestablish legal and social control during the county's settlement period. I will be exploring whether or not these mob massacres were effective and showing some of the difficulties in determining an answer. I will also be describing the mini massacres that happened post-lynching, and we'll look briefly at two subtopics, prison pardons and the use of some non-traditional historical portraits from the 1800s. Now, you probably all recognize the photos in the top row there. There's Butch Cassidy, Doc Holliday, the tintype there of Billy the Kid sold for $2.3 million 3 years ago at a Denver auction. Yeah, true. Now, the bottom row, you probably can recognize the men by their uniforms, although their faces are not familiar. These are all convicted Park County murderers wearing the prison uniform of the 1800s. Now, I will show this slide again at the end, and I will be asking you if you can pick out the row of prominent citizens of Park County and the row of convicted murderers of Park County. And I will be explaining why these photos are significant. It is important to give you a brief history of Park County in which to set the background for the mini and mob massacres. Park County was one of the first 17 original territorial counties established by the first Legislative Assembly in 1861. Some of the other original counties included Summit, Lake, and El Paso. Now, the map on the left, as you can see, is a historic map. The map on the right, the yellow circles, show where the mini massacres occurred. A lot of people ask where Park County is located, and the answer is easy because it's right in the center of the state. In fact, the center falls right in about 11 Mile Reservoir. The county is accessed by four scenic passes, and if you're coming from Colorado Springs, you'll be going over Wilkerson Pass up on Highway 24. And looking down from the top of the pass, the basin that you see, the grassland basin, is called the South Park Basin. That was formed millions of years ago and was an ancient ocean. The area is so significant culturally and historically that the South Park Basin and the Mosquito Range Mountains were named a National Heritage Area 3 years ago. And there are only two other heritage areas in the entire state. Prior to the county being settled by the white man, it was home to the Ute Indians and fur trappers. With the advent of Colorado's gold rush in 1859, a two-pronged approach was utilized, if you will, where miners from the north, from Central City, came over Kenosha Pass and settled just north of Como in an area they called Terryall. And then the second wave of explorers came in from up Ute Pass or the Pikes Peakers, the Pikes Peak Gold Rush. The photo in the top left is the waymark for the Terryall diggings, as they're called, although the waymark is actually a few miles north of Como. And then the photo at the bottom is where the Pikes Peakers first settled in a mining camp called Buckskin Joe. And Buckskin Joe is located about a mile west of Alma, although it no longer exists now. So back to the 10 mini massacres. I will be telling you briefly each story of each of the 10 episodes. And this came out to about a 25% per capita murder rate based on a population of almost 4,000 in 1880. Yeah, 10 murders in a year's time, unfortunately, worked out to a high statistical rate. So I'm going to be starting at the bottom there with Frank Jones. And Frank was a bartender who lived in Fairplay, and on the night of March 31st, 1879, he was in the Red Light Dance Hall. I don't make this up. And after dancing with a young lady, he hopped up on the bar counter. Well, the house manager that night, named Jack Jones, no relation, told him to get down or he would shoot him down. Well, all of a sudden, the sheriff came in and told everybody to quiet down, and all of a sudden, Frank pulled out a gun and shot Jack, who was standing behind the bar counter. Well, the sheriff collared Frank, and as he was marching him out the door, the bartender, who was underneath the counter, jumped up and fired at Frank, almost hitting the sheriff instead. Then the next murder happened the very next day. A man named John Hoover owned a billiard parlor in Fairplay, and he became upset when a young man who had been hired to clean out a water ditch let some of the water run up onto Hoover's property. The young man's name was Thomas Bennett, and then he went over to the Fairplay Hotel, I guess, to take a break. And we do have a picture of the original Fairplay Hotel right in the 1880s there. Well, Hoover was mad, so he downed some liquid courage in the form of whiskey and strode over to the hotel and walked in and shot Bennett right in the chest. The next mini massacre happened in May of 1879 when a man named Otto Wangella got into an argument in an Alma saloon with a Mr. Murray over a woman. He hit Mr. Murray on the head with his gun butt, infection set in, and Murray died a couple of days later. Wangella was traced to Denver about a week later, and he was in the company of the woman they had been arguing over, and he was wearing some type of disguise. It didn't say what. The next mini massacre was in the fall of 1879 when Daniel Keogh staggered into an Alma saloon on the night of October 30 and walked up to a group of men who were sitting around the fire. He kicked the chair legs out from one of the men sitting there and almost knocked the fellow out of his chair. Well, Keogh, when the man stood up to tell him to stop that, Keogh pulled out his revolver and fired, but the man was able to dodge the proverbial bullet. But unfortunately, the bullet hit the next object, which was an innocent bystander. His name was Daniel Ryan, and he fell to the floor dead. Then we have three murders right in a row in the little town of Weston, which is about 10 miles south of Fairplay. And at the time, Weston was considered the end of the track for the Denver, South Park, and Pacific Railroad. On October 23rd, 1879, a gambler named Red Hanley shot and killed the man he was playing cards with over the card game gone bad. Then on November 12th, a bartender shot and killed a patron who came in and ordered a drink and told him to charge it. Well, that didn't work. So an argument ensued, and the bartender ended up shooting his patron. Then 3 days before Christmas, a man named Dick Rourke shot and killed the blacksmith by mistake. He was actually aiming for a man he had been arguing with named Joe Miller, but Miller once again pushed the gun away, and the bullet flew into the next room and killed the blacksmith, who was just standing in there. Now, going up to up north there, up to where the letter C and K are, the K stands for the little mining town of King. Como had coal mines, and the King mine was the closest mine to Como and the largest mine. And in 1879, there was quite a labor conflict between the Italian and Chinese miners. Governor John Evans ordered 20 armed guards to come down from Denver and guard the mines. Well, two of the guardsmen who were bunking in together got into an argument when one of them spilled kerosene on the other by mistake. So an argument ensued, and a man named John Laughlin ended up shooting Gus Cornog. Now, the last two mini massacres happened in the town of Alma, both in 1880. Cicero Sims was a part-time miner and part-time troublemaker who had lived for a while with a man named John Jansen. And on the night of January 25th, they went and had dinner together. And then afterwards, they went outside, and they were just horse-playing around. Sims was young. He was only 19, and so they were knocking each other's hats off their head. Well, all of a sudden, Sims got mad because Jansen wouldn't replace the hat, and he pulled out his gun, shot Jansen in the chest on the main streets of Alma, right in front of everybody. And then 2 months later, a miner named William Porter, or Wild Bill, as he was known, got into an argument with a young Irishman in a saloon over religion. Well, the Irishman went out, Porter followed him, called him names, and same thing as Sims, pulled out his gun, shot him in the chest on the main streets of Alma, right in front of everybody. So as you can see now, we have these 10 mini massacres building up to the height of fear and the height of concern by the citizens, which ended up in two mob massacres. And if you're wondering who was lynched, Bill Porter, who I just talked about, who shot the Irishman, he was lynched right then and there from the jailhouse in Alma. The picture I have there of the jail is not the original jail that he was lynched from. It's probably the second jail. But it gives you an idea of what the buildings were like then. And then John Hoover, the one who had the water ditch problem, he was lynched actually from the courthouse window. A vigilante mob broke into the jail after demanding the keys from the sheriff in the middle of the night. And they took Hoover out, and they strung the rope up over the archway of the window and lynched Hoover there. So now the question becomes, were the mob massacres effective in deterring further murders? Well, in looking at this chart, I would say no, because as you can see, there were an additional 4 murders in the very same year, in 1880. Now granted, there was a 4-month hiatus in the summer of 1880, but then the murders picked up again in the fall. Although I must say they did dwindle. As you can see, there were only 2 in 1882, 1 in 1883, and so on. So the rate did go down, but it is difficult to determine the reason why. I can tell you about 2 of the murders that happened post-lynching, and these are what I call renegade ranchers. And they had 3 things in common. They both shot their victims. They both had serious boundary conflicts with their neighbors as to where the fencing lines should be. And they both felt threatened enough when their victims picked up rocks to throw at them that they decided they needed to use deadly force. And both these men were convicted and went to prison. So although the county never experienced 10 mini massacres within a year's period again, this can't solely be attributed to the mob massacres. I've listed some reasons why this is so difficult to determine. It's really hard to hold the personal variables constant, such as the environment, the individual's propensity towards violence. We do at least know about their drinking, because it seems like most of these did happen in saloons. But we don't know how much they drank. And then it's also hard to hold constant some of the other factors, the time and case factors. You know, where do you cut off the year as to make it statistically significant in determining the statistics? Should you include acquittals? Should you include murders that happened out of county but by Park County citizens? Or should you include murders that happen by out-of-county citizens committed in Park County, it can get pretty complicated. And I will say that there was at least one law enforcement shooting that probably did not need to happen, that probably could have been considered a murder. So now I'd like to talk about what I call the parade of pardons. All these men were convicted of murder, and as you can see, all served less than their full sentence. And in some cases, some served a very short period of time. But what is so interesting about this is that at the time these murders occurred, you know, they were, in the newspapers, they were described as the worst crime of the century, and, you know, they were the worst dastardly deeds that had ever happened. And yet, only a few years later, when they were pardoned, everyone seemed pretty much accepting of it. And Frank Jones, who had shot the bartender Jack Jones, the reason for his pardon was that the conviction of the prisoner was largely the result of an excited state of feeling in Park County at the time in regard to the prevalence of crime, which public feeling operated strongly and unfairly against the accused. So much for frontier justice. Okay, so now we're back to our slide again. How many think the top row is the row of convicted murderers? No. How many think the bottom row? You're right. But I will tell you why I think these are significant, in that, you know, the men on the top row, they were judges, lawyers, wealthy ranch and mine owners, but the men on the bottom are the common man, if you will, and I suggest that these may be the only known images that exist of these men, and these were the men who were the workers. On the bottom there is Charles Baker. He was a ranch hand. In the oval is Cicero Sims. He's the one who shot his friend John Jansen. David Morris was a railroad worker. Labrado Mora was a sheep herder. And Levi Streeter was the Como town shoe cobbler. So I think if you can remove the stigma of murder for just a minute, I think these images are significant. So I have some postcards out on the table there. If you would pick one up, my book will be out later next month, and you can order through my website or through Filter Press Books, who is publishing it. Thank you. And that's it. Thanks.
Christy, your second murderer reminds me of one of the best excuses I ever had from a student for missing an exam. In New Mexico, I said, "Why'd you miss the exam?" He said, "Some SOB has been diverting water from my acequia, and I stayed up all night with my shotgun to get him." I said, "Oh, that's just fine." Okay. Jeff Broom, our next presenter, is a fifth-generation Colorado native. He had family residing in Colorado in 1864, including a relative who fought at Sand Creek. Jeff is an historian, author, and theologian. Currently, he is professor of philosophy at Arapahoe Community College in Littleton, Colorado, where he was honored as the Faculty Member of the Year in 2011-2012. He earned a bachelor's degree from Colorado State University Pueblo, an MA from Baylor University, and a PhD in philosophy from the University of Colorado Boulder. He has written two books on the Indian Wars of 1867 to 1869. One, Dog Soldier Justice, The Ordeal of Susanna Alderdice in the Kansas Indian War, and the other one, Custer into the West. Mr. Broom.
Let me figure out how to work this. That is my relative, by the way. We might as well get that out of the way. That's Hugh Melrose, who enlisted here in Colorado City and was in the 3rd Colorado Cavalry. And in my research on the Indian Wars, of which I've done a lot on the Hungate, I received a call from somebody in Texas who's his great-great-grandson and said, "Well, I think we're related because he married your great-great-aunt, your great-great grandfather's sister, who he brought out here to Colorado in 1863 from Tennessee. William Watson was my great-great-grandfather, who town of Wetmore is where his homestead was. But Hugh Melrose here, he had a picture of him, and so he gave me that, and that's going to come out in my new book that I just finished up. And I've never seen a picture of a 100-dayer in uniform. So I thought that was pretty unique. And then as I did my research, I learned here in your collections in the Pioneer Museum, the memoirs of Lieutenant Templeton, who was the commander of Hugh Melrose, and Templeton's memoirs said, in the heaviest fighting at Sand Creek, Private Hugh Melrose killed White Antelope. I have a connection to a massacre. I did not know that. So there's that that I just shared with you. I'm going to go through my slides quick because I've got 40 of them and I've got 20 minutes. With the books, I have The Dog Soldier Justice, and you heard about that. I've brought that to sell here, along with Custer and To the West. And I've also brought some pamphlets that I've done with the Denver Westerners. And the Pike Peak Westerners is one of the supporters of this. And the Denver Westerners I've been very active in, and I have some publications there. This one on the right is an interesting one with Wild Bill Hickok killing a Medal of Honor recipient in Wild Brawl in Hays. And I've written on the Hun Gates. The pamphlet on the left I have here, and so Indian raids in Elbert County. This is the Hun Gate site, and this is at the intersections of County Line Road of Elbert County and Douglas County, and it's getting built up now. I have a little, well, that won't work, but right out to the left there is where the cabin was, that happened on June 11th, 1864. The family was Nathan Hungate, who was 29, his wife Ellen Decker Hungate, who was 25. Their two children, Laura, who was born in 1861, and Florence, who was just 5 months old. They were all killed on June 11th. The cabin was burned down, and the big what-ifs on that and what happened and did it feed, did it fuel Sand Creek, and all of that is what I've been interested in. There's a standard view of the Hun Gate massacre, and that is that Nathan Hun Gate was away from home tending the ranch, and he was actually working for Isaac Van Warmer, who owned the ranch and the land, and he was with another man named Mr. Miller, who they saw smoke coming from the direction of the house a few miles away, and Mr. Miller went to Denver and reported to Governor Evans the massacre late on the day of June 11th, and Nathan went back to tend to his family, and before he could get there, the Indians had already killed his family and burned the house down as he saw that, so they were leaving, and they caught him about a mile and a half away from the cabin and killed him. So that's where his body was found. I think the whole thing's false, it's repeated again and again in every book on Sand Creek, and this is the most recent one with Harvard University Press, an excellent book dealing with all of the controversy around Sand Creek. It's only been out about a couple of months. But this is what he says in there, and I'm not going to read it. You can look at it. It's the standard story that I just shared in the words of that historian. But you can notice that, you know, some accounts suggest that his wife had been raped. There's even a question whether or not Indians did this that some historians raise. There's no question that the Indians did it. And there's also no question that Mrs. Hungate was outraged before she was killed. The earliest accounts confirm that. Here's another one. I've picked out a couple of the standard views. This is an excellent book by David Berthong on the Southern Cheyennes that came out in 1963, repeating it again, and we have Miller named and all of that. These are the books where that story appears. These are all basically the standard books on the Sand Creek Massacre. And they go on and on and on and repeat that story. However, where does that story of Mr. Miller come from, and how far back can you trace it to? It starts in 1892 in a newspaper called the Denver Republican. And the reason why there's a story in 1892 is the original cemetery that the family was buried in, and they were brought into Denver the next day, and they were put on display for a little bit, showing their gruesome injuries and that, and then buried where Cheeseman Park is in Denver now. And as Denver grew, they removed the cemetery, the graves in the cemetery at Cheeseman Park, and opened Fairmount Cemetery, and that was 1892. So when they opened the coffin of the Hungates, and that's what this story was about. And so there's an older gentleman there says, "Well, wait, I worked with Mr. Hungate, and I was with him that day." And you know that 25 years after Woodstock, more people were there than, that actually happened, and this is that 25-year, 30-year period. You know, we got a lot of people in Vietnam that that are my age today saying that they fought in Vietnam. So this is where it traces back to, and then in 1935. Well, I want to come back on this one in a minute. In 1935, I think it's the daughter of Isaac Van Worm, it could be the granddaughter, older in life and recalling what her father said about the Hungates, and she claimed that her father took the bodies into Denver, and he didn't. The reports back at the time indicates who brought them in. But she also then repeated that story. And she repeated a story, too, that she said her father told her, and that was when the bodies were found, the mother and the two children were in the well and had been pulled out after they'd been killed and all that. And that was false. And so in 1935, the daughter of Van Wormer then repeated that story. But if we go back to the newspapers of the time, the first newspaper account came out on June 15th, 4 days after the event. And you should know that the Rocky Mountain News at this time couldn't produce anything because the big flood that Cherry Creek and knocked down the press and all that, and I think carried part of it all the way to Brighton, and so they were out of commission for several weeks, and so the Denver Republican made the first report. And notice there that it says that the body of the man was found about 2 miles from the house, but his whip was found at the ruins. It already mentioned earlier that the house was burned, and some other marks seem to indicate that he had first been attacked there, and finding himself overpowered, he made an effort to escape. And I found evidence that that was true. I'll get on in a minute on this. There are two things that I've brought to the Hungate story that has not been brought in by other people, and one is archaeology, the other is information from the National Archives in Washington, D.C. that you cannot get on microfilm, that you have to go visit, and I've spent a lot of money and time there. And it's from those, they're called Indian depredation claims. And here's a little bit about them. One of the record groups is called 123. In the storage space of these Indian depredation claims covers almost 3 football fields. I mean, that is an amazing amount of space. There's almost 12,000 files of individual American citizens who filed claims against the government for attacks on their property. And there was old laws and all that that went on that said that if the Indians who attacked you were in treaty with the United States, you could file a claim against them, it would go into the Department of Interior and be investigated and all that, and you would be compensated for your property loss. The interesting thing about these is that one of the requirements for a claim is that you had to have sworn affidavits and witnesses backing up your affidavits of the accounts. So you get, it's just loaded with first-hand accounts. I just finished a book called Cheyenne War, Indian Raids on the Roads to Denver, 1864-1869, which covers the Santa Fe Trail, Smoky Hill Trail, and what I call the Denver Road, which is the South Platte River, which is I-76 roughly. And there's just numerous claims that I've consulted in them, all kinds of massacres all over the place happening that have never made the print or anything, and they're hidden in these Indian depredation claims. But there are no claims by Isaac Van Warmer or the Hungate family, for that matter. And part of the reason might be that you had, if you were in Indian territory, you had to prove permission to be in the territory. And that was a requirement for a successful claim. And at the time of the Hungate massacre, all of this area was Indian territory. That was changed in the Treaty of Little Arkansas in 1865, but before that. So maybe that might be why there was no claim. But also, nobody's been able to discover how many claims were filed that were finally compensated. These 12,000 claims, only about 30% were compensated. When a claim was paid, the claim disappears in the National Archives to other record groups, and it's a real hunt to try to find them. So it's possible that Isaac Van Warmer and the Hungate descendants, the family was wiped out, but Nathan came from a large family of, I think, 15 brothers and sisters. So there could have been a claim filed by relatives. And maybe they were paid or something, but they haven't been found. But there are claims of two people in the area that helps us to understand what was going on at this time. Now, in the claims of one, in one of those claims that I discovered was Thomas Dara. And there was a lot of firsthand testimony about Dara. He'd lost, he was a freighter, and he lost about 30 mules, again, near the Hungate site on June 10th. And he went to Denver, and he reported his loss. And by the way, he was the first one to report to Governor Evans about the raids that were going on. He reports back in late on the day of June 11th at about midnight with two other freighters, and they ends up being the freighter's report, and this is not Mr. Miller at all. But at any rate, he also, as he was going into Denver to make his report, he came up upon the loss of John Brown. It was bringing in six freight wagons. We all know Hickenlooper. We all know Weinkoop's Brewery. That building was the John Sidney Brown building. And so when you go up there, if you ever go in there, you're sitting in John Brown's building. Wasn't there in 1864, but he was a successful merchant and businessman in Denver along with his brother, Junius. And they were bringing six wagons of freight into Denver, and they had gone into their camp, the last camp, and at the lunchtime, and they had set the mules out to graze, and the Indians came through and stole them all. And that was only about 8 miles north of the Hungate place. They didn't know about that then. But Dara saw that as he was going in, because that was the way into Denver, and he reported that. He knew John Brown. He told John Brown in Denver, your freights have been, the Indians stole all the mules and all that. So John Brown got another guy named Corbin, and the three of them actually didn't meet up then, because what happened was Governor Evans wrote an order out to Thomas Dara to take it to some soldiers camped on Cherry Creek, roughly about where Franktown is today, and because those were the closest soldiers, and to lead them back to the area of the raids and stuff. And that was what he went with that, and then Corbin and Brown went to where roughly about where Bennett, Colorado is, found where the freight wagons were, and the freighters that were actually able to recover a few of the mules as they chased the Indians. There were a couple mules that were left, and they used those to follow and all that. Interesting thing with all these freighters, there were eight of them. I think it was three of them were armed with pistols. That was all. When the Indians raided them, they were armed with guns and pistols and bows and arrows and made no attempt to attack them. They could have easily wiped out that wagon train. This is what I have just said, and Brown gets his friend Corbin, and off they go. So, you know, we can pass that slide. I got 40 slides in 20 minutes. And Brown, again, had discovered from his wagon master that that they had followed the Indians south, and that was where that was going to take them to the Hungate site. And the Indians, again, were armed when they stole the stock, but made no effort to harm any of the men. So they journeyed south in an attempt to recover the rest of the stock, which they didn't get. But near present-day Elizabeth on Running Creek, they found the soldiers with their friend Thomas Darrah, because the soldiers had come up from Elizabeth. Running Creek is a creek that goes through Elizabeth, and it flows north. So they were following that north, and that's when they discovered the Hun Gates. When Thomas Darrah first came in, the Hun Gates had not been reported. He didn't know that. He had left that area on the 10th. But so they found the bodies there. But when they found the bodies, they actually didn't find the bodies there. They found a note there saying that the bodies that were carried to Gomer's Mill, and I have Philip Gomer's depredation claim, and there's an account in there that clarifies all this stuff too, and talks about that. So the soldiers are ordered to go back, and so Darrah stays with his two freighters, and the three of them then go into Denver to report the Hun Gate murder. And as they're following Running Creek north, and they go about a mile and a half, and on the other side of the creek, they find the mutilated remains of Nathan Hun Gate. Now, the archaeology that I brought in there, oh, by the way, when the Gomer was attacked too, and only a woman was there, and she actually chased the lone Arapaho for a couple of miles. He was armed, made no attempt to harm her. This is the way it was back then. So why were they killed? I'm going to go on this stuff and get into the reasons why they were killed. We think that they were killed because there was an impending Indian war, and this was the first victims. And that wasn't the case. There was an impending Indian war, and the first victims were over 50 victims in Nebraska. That correctly starts the Indian War. This is one of the accounts in one of the depredation claims where those 50 settlers were killed. And you can see the mutilations in there. I don't need to read it. These were the things that were reported immediately on the stage that came through and saw this into Denver. This is what fueled the Third Colorado within days was organized after these reports came in. And then Sand Creek happened. Now, these were the captives that were released with Black Kettle and then the Camp Weld Conference. I have other things, and I want to get into the archaeology real quick. And that is, I spent several days in a summer with a team of people metal detecting the site. And it's a field, as you saw, and I found several weapons, and I had them analyzed by Doug Scott, the famous frontier archaeologist, and he noted that they were all burned. This one here is the breech of a Warner carbine, and it exploded. This is the front of it. It exploded from heavy fire, heavy fire. And they were burned out of their house while Nathan Hun Gate was there, and they made quite a defense. I found five weapons, parts of five weapons, all kinds of bullets there showing a long siege, burned bullets, all kinds of shell casings showing that. The one weapon I couldn't find was the Henry shell case, the Henry, which would hold 16 rounds, and that explains that's what Nathan left with. That's why he could get a mile and a half before he ran out of ammunition. He was killed. Had they been home, the women, they would have pillaged the cabin before they burned it. These are all harmonicas and all of the music pipe, pitch pipe, pocket watch, all kinds of personal items that the Indians would have taken, including those weapons. So there was just a lot found there at the end there. I got 1 minute left. The one over there on the right, that's a little slate 22 caliber. That was probably to teach little Laura how to starting her to write, because that's that was in there. All of that stuff was burned. Thank you.
Rick, Christy, if you could come up, we have some time for questions. Yeah. Questions? Yes, sir. The question was, if you go into Google Ngram, can it distinguish whether
again, when whites are victorious is a battle.
Oh, okay. Yeah, does it indicate that one side calls it a massacre and the other side doesn't quite see it that way. No. All Google has done is scanned several million books in English, and it just tells you how many times the term shows up. Another question. Yes, ma'am.
The last presentation, I kind of missed it. Is part of your thinking that the Indians did not attack because they didn't pillage the place, or I guess I kind of just wanted to see how that figures into your thinking.
Okay, the question is, in the Hungate affair, did the Indians really do it, or...
I think, yeah, the question that I understand it, and it's a good question because I didn't bring it up and I meant to, and that is, so, okay, why did the Indians kill the Hungates? And the answer that I came to was, you see, all this theft had been going on for as much as 2 days before. There were over 400 cattle and horses and mules taken from that area by the various ranchers and all that. And so the word was already out. Dara had suffered his loss before the Hungates were killed. So my speculation was is that he saw an Indian stealing the stock outside the house, and he shot him. And that gave the motivation for the Indians to come back and burn him out. The Indians, as I've found and this isn't unique to the Indians, this was unique to the times and all that, was very retaliatory against anything that happened to them. And you get back against those people who get you. And so so Nathan, I think, shot an Indian. I don't know if he killed him or wounded him, but that was their motive for coming back. I guess I could add to that I've received, and I'm corresponding with a guy named David Hungate, and he's a descendant from one of the brothers of the Hungates, and he's read my stuff, and he said the Hungates have a history of being very short-tempered, and I think you're very right about that. And he says, I've been studying this stuff all my life, and when I came across your thesis, it just makes a perfectly good sense. David Hungate, by the way, is a famous bass player that's played with Sonny and Sharon Boskaggs, and he tours with Vince Gill, and he was the founder of a rock group called Toto. He lives in Nashville.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, hi. Cause-effect is difficult to determine when saying who did what to whom. So it's interesting that you mentioned Nebraska. I'm going to look that up. But also, the first governor of Colorado Territory, William Gilpin, increased land sales by marketing Colorado in Great Britain in 1861 and 62. Also, of course, the Civil War started. The Treaty of Fort Wise in February 1861 was not fair to the Cheyenne. 1862, Battle of Glorieta Pass. 1862, also the Dakota Uprising in Mankato, Minnesota, where I forgot how many...
Do you have a question, ma'am? I said not on my watch, not on my watch. I'm an old professor, I can... How can we arrive at a cause and effect as to what resulted in Sand Creek?
Robert North had lived among the Arapahos for a number of years, and he came to Governor Evans in 1863, and he reported that the Indians are smoking the war pipe, and they're going to continue to trade until they get enough arms and ammunition to start a general Indian war. And they're going to do on the roads to Denver what they did up in Minnesota. They're going to wipe out all the white settlers, send them on. In fact, the Lakota from Minnesota had come down and brought that war pipe to them, and they had agreed to it. There are references to that in many, many firsthand accounts that I found in depredation claims of what they called squaw men that owned ranches that said, you know, that they came to us to warn us that they're going to start the war and stuff. And I think that Robert North's warning was correct. And I think that the Indians saw that, especially with the gold rush, that was the main cause, because here come all the whites. Here come all the whites, and they're not leaving. And I think there was a plan to start it, and I think it started on Plum Creek in Little Blue in Nebraska on August 7th and 8th, 1864.
Another question. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. In all your research, has anyone gone back to the Indian tribes and asked them for the stories that they have? So it can be compared, because their stories are told over and over and over, and so we're just hearing, it appears to me, that we're only hearing the white side of the Westerners who are out here, and we're not hearing the Indian side, what they felt happened or what did happen. Maybe they were antagonized. We don't know.
The question is there today a consideration of the Native American point of view as far as many of the atrocities, the massacres that we've been talking about and that we will be talking about?
Well, the answer to that was it was all oral history until George Bent committed his memories to letters, and starting in 1904 and going on for about a dozen years. But in the depredation claims, there are one of the things with the depredation claims is that the claims were brought to the tribal council by the Indian agent and asked, did you do this? So they have a time to say yes or no. And in my book coming out, Cheyenne War, I list about 14 different reasons that the Indians give. And a big one was the loss of timber and the affecting of the buffalo migration that the trails have brought on. But I lay all that out in Cheyenne War. And by the way, I meant to say, I have an email address. If you, you pick up a card from me, you can email me and I can give you the details of when that book comes out about Thanksgiving.
I would add to that that the National Park Service and the Santa Fe Trail Association in the last 3 years have been holding what are called listening sessions with the Cheyenne, the Arapaho, the Osage, specifically with reference to what happened along the Santa Fe Trail. And all we do, the Park Service and the Santa Fe Trail Association, is go and listen. There isn't even an agenda. It's just start talking and tell us, just talk to us. Yeah, Nancy?
And in Minnesota, last year was the 150th of the Dakota Council. And they've done the same thing. They've set up a reconciliation.
Okay, so in Minnesota, the Reconciliation Council. Yes, ma'am.
I know that William C. Bear is a translator from the Arapaho tribe. I visited Wind River, and I'm sure Margaret Cole, if she was here, she would talk about it. There were so many of those buffalo type drawings of the massacre, and you take the story in the Sand Creek Massacre happened where the Arapaho tell it and the Cheyenne tell the exact same story. So there are many historians now writing these stories so that they don't just have one version of what happened in all of the country. So definitely there are people that are all doing that. And I know that because I'm a professional poet. Thank you.
Along that same line, I have a question for Rick and then we'll wind it up. As a New Mexico State historian, a lot of controversy swirls around you. Does the state historian's office, I don't know what I want to ask, but does the state historian's office deal with this sort of situation and how?
Yes, carefully. What I say is that New Mexico history has a lot of constituencies. And so, yes, we try to listen to all of them and try to present all of them. 25 years ago, nobody talked about ethnohistory, really. And now a lot of historians, I mean, as I'm basically a Spanish colonial historian, so I'm dealing with a written record that was written by the victors. But you do try to read between the lines and find informants that can tell their side of the story. I don't know of any informants that have a side of this story. This story has been told so many times in the most, I'm not even sure the word I'm looking for, the most exaggerated way, the largest casualty figures, in order to make it a very dramatic story. I think most historians now, I'll try to include the Native American voice when we're writing about about that. Okay. But it's something you have to be careful about.